Hi, welcome to the Frihoffer Institute of Progressive Halacha. I'm Rabbi Mark Wyshovsky with the 12-Minute Shiur number 40, When Halacha and Ethics Collide, Part 3, Some Takanot on Marriage. We'll be using a source sheet that you can download at our website. That's www.frihoffinstitute.org/learning, and scroll down to the 12-Minute Shiur. Our previous two installments have considered how the rabbis respond when a particular mitzvah or a rule of halacha conflicts with the standards of justice and equity that the Torah commands us to uphold. In Shiur 39, we discussed the process of takana, whereby the rabbis enact an ordinance, a piece of legislation that repairs the problem, repair being the meaning of the word takana or the verb litakein. And were we to ask them to justify this power, I mean, where do the rabbis get off thinking that they can repair or change or amend or suspend a mitzvah of the Torah? We saw that one theory is Hefker Beit Din, the power of the Beit Din to confiscate property from one party and hand it to another, a power that the rabbis were convinced the Torah grants to them. That theory helps explain the pros bull, the rabbinic takana that overrides the biblical cancellation of debts in the sabbatical year. Okay, so much for Shiur number 39. In this installment, we'll see how the power of Hefker Beit Din enables some important takanot concerning marriage. The rabbis perceived that the legal institution of marriage, as defined by the Torah, raised serious problems of justice and equity. So they issued takanot that essentially redefined that institution. What do we mean by this? Well, take a look at the pasuk Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, lines 3 through 8 on the source sheet. Ki yikach ish isha uve'alah. When a man takes a wife and cohabits with her, should he find her displeasing due to something unseemly about her, he writes her a document of divorce, places it in her hand, and sends her from his house. The rabbis read this verse as the basis for most of the halakha of divorce and of the formation of marriage. Now, for our purposes, the verse teaches us two essential points. First, under biblical law, the creation and termination of marriage are private matters left entirely to the contractual relationship between two individuals or families. There's no indication here that the community has any business interfering in the financial aspects of that contract. And second, the husband wields the exclusive power of divorce. He writes the document of divorce, we call it a get, and hands it to the wife, not the other way around. And while the verse hints at some grounds for divorce, the halakha concludes that he may divorce her for almost any reason. If he does so, the wife who is not independently wealthy can be left economically destitute. This sort of arbitrary power can be a powerful tool of intimidation in the hands of an unscrupulous husband. So to repair this obvious weakness in the structure of the Torahitic law of marriage, the rabbis legislated through takana something called ketubah. We're referring here not to the document of that name, which is often done up very artistically, but to the debt that the husband undertakes at the inception of marriage, a debt payable to his wife upon his death or upon divorce. This is an effort to limit the discretionary power of divorce that the Torah in Deuteronomy grants to the husband. The idea is expressed in Masechet Ketubot, Daf 11a, lines 13 through 16. Ketubah haynu ta'ama shelo tehe kala be'enav lehotziyah. What is the reason for the ketubah? So that it should not be an easy matter for a husband to divorce his wife. The debt known as the ketubah is therefore a disincentive to divorce. Yeah, the husband still enjoys the power to divorce at his discretion, but now if he uses that power, it's going to cost him. More than that, this takana signals that the financial arrangements between husband and wife are no longer exclusively a private contractual matter. The community, acting through the Beit Din, is now defining the terms of that marriage contract. Even the ketubah, which is framed as a private obligation that the husband willingly undertakes toward his wife, is in fact a requirement that's enforced upon him by the community. Look at Mishnah Ketubot, chapter 4, Mishnah 7, beginning on line 23. Lo katav la ketubah, what if the husband did not write a ketubah prior to the chuppah? Sorry, honey, I was so busy planning the wedding that I forgot to undertake that debt, that obligation. I guess that means you're stuck, right? Wrong. Betula gova ma'atayim va'almana maneh mipnei shehu tanai beit din. She still collects at the time of divorce or the husband's death 200 zuz if she was previously unmarried, or 100 zuz if she was married before, because this is a stipulation of the court, the Beit Din. By the way, 200 zuz was considered an average yearly income in those days, so we're talking substantial sums here. This is revolutionary when you think about it. A debt, a promise to pay a certain sum of money at a future date, is supposed to be undertaken voluntarily. In this case, there apparently is no debt, no debtor. The husband never made a promise to pay, but the court will enforce that promise as though he actually made it of his own free will, collecting it, if necessary, from his estate through the power of confiscation of Hefker Beit Din. The Torah's private contract has therefore become a matter of community regulation. Moreover, the Mishnah tells us that the Takanah further defines the terms of the debt. Line 24. Katav la sadeh shaveh maneh tachat ma'atayim zuz. Suppose the husband mortgages a particular field for the ketubah debt, one of the fields that he owns. It's security for the obligation. It turns out that at the time of payment, the field is worth only half the amount of the debt. What he should have written was, kol nichasim de'itli achrayin l'ketubatach. All my property is mortgaged for your ketubah. He didn't make that promise, but the court will act as though he did, confiscating that field and an additional 100 zuz worth of his property from his estate, because it's a Tanai Beit Din, a stipulation of the court based upon Hefker Beit Din, the power of the court to confiscate property. Now, the Takanot don't stop there. The Mishnah records a number of other financial commitments that the rabbis require of the husband. Some are simpler, while others are complex. A simple one, though a sad one, a sign of difficult historical circumstances, begins on line 37. The husband must promise in the ketubah document to redeem his wife, to ransom her should she be taken captive. If he doesn't write that clause, the court will force him, Hefker Beit Din and all that, to pay the ransom. A more complicated takanah is called the Ketubat Banin Dichrin, which is Aramaic for Banim Zecharim, male offspring. The text begins on line 45. Here's the situation. Suppose the wife dies during her husband's lifetime. In that case, he inherits her ketubah as well as the property she brought into the marriage. Now, when he dies, then, according to the Torah, his sons will inherit all his assets. So far, okay. Now, some of these sons may also be the sons of his deceased wife, which would be very convenient, but others may be the offspring of previous or subsequent marriages. This clause requires that their sons, that is, the sons of this wife by her husband, shall inherit her ketubah and her property, in addition to their share of the rest of Dad's estate, which they divvy up with their stepbrothers, their father's sons by other wives. Okay, now, what's so important about all this? As we know, biblical law provides that only sons and not daughters inherit the property of a parent. We, of course, regard this as an inequity. Well, it turns out so did the rabbis. And while they did not figure out a way to rewrite the Torah's inheritance law, they sought to equalize matters by encouraging a father to make gifts to his daughter prior to his death, before the law of inheritance, or Yerusha, kicks in and hands the money to his sons. And blood being thicker than water, the rabbis knew that a father would be more likely to make gifts of money and property to his daughter if he knew that those assets would remain in the family, that they would ultimately pass down to her sons, that is, to his grandsons, and not to the sons of her husband by other wives. It's a circuitous way of repairing an ethical imbalance in the law of the Torah, which cuts daughters almost entirely out of the chain of inheritance. Now, the other Mishnayot on the page, lines 55 through 77, also speak to the financial disadvantages that women suffer under Torah law. The husband is required, in the event of his death, to provide maintenance for his unmarried daughters and for his widow, situations that the Torah itself doesn't address. In all these cases, rabbinic legislation comes to right an ethical imbalance. In all these cases, the takana, which operates, as we've seen, on the power of Hefker Beit Din, the power of the rabbinic court to take property, in this case from the husband, and hand it to the wife or to her family, the takana serves as a subtle, or maybe not so subtle, critique of the legal structure of marriage rooted in the Torah itself, a structure that goes all the way back to Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. In all these cases, the rabbis utilize a power they believe is granted to them by the Torah to effectively change the law of the Torah, trying as best they can to ensure that justice prevails when halakha and ethics collide. Now, you may be wondering, whatever happened to this power of rabbinic legislation? Why don't the rabbis use takanot to address social injustice and inequity these days? Well, that's a good question, and a long one for which we don't have time now, but we promise to return to it somewhere down the line at a future date. In the meantime, this has been the 12-Minute Shiur number 40 from the Frihof Institute of Progressive Halakha. Thanks for learning with us. Lehitraot.